I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today's show is all about music. A little later in the program, we hear and discuss chorale works inspired by the Hebrew Bible. But first, a musical exploration of Jewish involvement in American theater. Stuart Hecht is an associate professor of theater at Boston College and the longstanding editor of the New England Theater Journal. He's also the author of Transposing Broadway, Jews, Assimilation, and the American Musical. He joins us from our WGBH studio in Boston. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you for having me.
The American musical got its start in New York City around the time we start to see an increase in population of Jews in New York. What brought Jews to New York City, and at what point in history do we see them becoming involved in the creation of these shows?
Well, it's complicated, but I'll try and give you a quick answer. How's that? The 1880s saw the biggest migration of Jews to the United States. There are already German Jews here, but the mass migration really came from Russia, many of whom were fleeing pogroms, which were religious-based raids by the peasants where the police looked the other way. And most settled in New York because it was the first place there. I mean, that's where Ellis Island is, though other people settled in various places, including Boston. And many settled then on the Lower East Side of New York, which became a polyglot of different ethnicities, not only the Jewish, seeking ways of stepping out of the ghetto, I suppose. A lot of Jews found themselves in vaudeville, which was not unusual in those days, as were minstrel shows before that, for minorities to find a way to, without education and without connections, to have access to the dominant culture, if you will, make a living, make some money. Improved their lot. Many became producers and stuff, but there was a great hesitancy, even though so many of the producers were Jewish, to actually place Jews on stage. I think that there was a lot of fear. And if you come from a background with pogroms, prejudice-based attacks, no wonder that they were so fearful.
Irving Berlin is widely known for his contributions to the American music. Tell us a little bit more about him, both his personal background and how he got involved in writing for Broadway.
Irving Berlin was born in a little village in Poland. His original name was Baleen, Israel Baleen. His father was a cantor, and his family experienced a pogrom. They literally hid in the fields next to the little town when the Russian peasants ran in and burned it to the ground. And I really believe this impacted him the rest of his life. His father soon thereafter managed to get the family together and come to America. And they settled on the Lower East Side of New York, impoverished in these densely populated, airless, sunless tenements. And when he was, I'm trying to remember exactly, I think when he was, I want to say 8 years old, he ran away from home because he thought himself a burden economically to the family. And his father died, which made it even harder. So he basically lived in the streets. And he's wandering around the Lower East Side, and he's listening to all these different ethnicities, you know, Germans and Irish and Italians and so on and so forth. And he's soaking up all the music. He's also literally dancing on the street corner or dancing in bars as a child, singing as well for pennies. So he really climbed up the hard way. He ended up as a singing waiter at a bar in the Lower East Side. And the story goes, and he actually was first mentioned in the newspapers because the Prince of Wales, of all people, was visiting. This is probably about, oh gosh, I'm guessing around 1910 or something, 1909. And he would sing dirty lyrics to popular songs. And the Duke of Wales, who was slumming, you know, he goes, this little thing, and hears this kid sing this way, or I guess teenager at this point. And he's so taken with him. He compliments him, and this actually makes the New York press. But then the owner of the bar realized that the Kitty Corner Bar, the bar on the opposite side of the street, the owner there had two of his singing waiters actually get a song published. So not to be outdone, he asked, not only asks, he demands of two of his singer waiters, one of which is Berlin, to write a song of their own. And the result is a song called, oh God, Marie of Sunny Italy. Yeah. And it was on and it became published. And on the sheet, that's the first time he changed his name, and it became Irving Berlin.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too. You talk about, you know, all of the different, you know, sort of melting pot, if you will, that was in the Lower East Side and all of these different languages and probably broken English. And it really makes you appreciate his talent for songwriting because He just seemed to have some kind of natural, innate ability to produce these wonderful songs.
It's true, isn't it? You know, I think especially, you know, the early stuff is heavily ethnic because that's what sold, because that's who was buying the sheet music. You know, nowadays people talk in terms of downloads. When I was a teenager, it was all talking about, you know, record sales. Mm-hmm. But in those days, it was sheet music. And here's a man who really dealt in ethnic stuff until World War I came along. You could argue, well, he's dealing in local dialect. He wasn't even high school educated, let alone college educated. But what's really remarkable is, first of all, of his mastery of the language, but also his extraordinary efficiency of the use of the language. I mean, he was just brilliant. But then even what's even more remarkable than that is you think about those great movie musicals of the 1930s, the ones with Fred and Ginger, you know, mm-hmm. and you think of them as the height of sophistication. I mean, Fred Astaire and his sister, Adele, performed in London before coming back to the States in 1924, 25. And they became friends with the royal family in England. And they also were vaudevillians, not well educated. But we think of Fred Astaire as being so polished and sophisticated. And those songs like, you know, Cheek to Cheek, Heaven, I'm in Heaven. And they're so beautiful, but they're so elegant.
Yeah.
And you're going, how in God's name could a little kid from a different country come to this nation? This is not his first language. Write these extraordinary melodies. But he was so adept as a lyricist,
yeah,
with great erudition.
Also, talk a little bit about the shift from songs written in the major key to a minor key.
Well, you know, I think that the American tradition, if you think in terms of 19th century song, which is popular song, most of what we think of as popular American music comes really out of minstrel shows and to some degree ethnic stuff like Irish ballads and things like that, you know, and marches. But basically, the English-based tradition and the Irish-based tradition is in the major key. And when and you think about it, you know, it's very much upbeat. It's, you know, stiff upper lip, you know, very can do. And then, but when you start having this generation that really is initiated by, well, it's initiated by Berlin. It's also initiated by Jerome Kern. But Berlin is the one who's the great song master. And he's writing songs that are sad. He's writing songs for shop girls. You know, in the 1910s and 20s was where women started to leave the farms in the small towns and move into the cities and get jobs. How dare they? How shocking, you know. But part of the deal was that these composers recognized that they were living lonely existences. And I think the Gershwins too, wrote a lot of songs specifically with this population in mind. And the songs are so poignant and powerful. You know, it's funny because in a non-Jew, Cole Porter, who was actually a very good friend of Berlin's, but he has these wonderful Liszt songs, and one of them is most famous is You're the Top. And one of the things he mentions is the very best of anything is a Berlin ballad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's in minor key, and minor keys tugged at your heartstrings.
Right.
And minor keys are about emotions and the sadness. And I think that comes, in a sense, directly from the cantorial traditions of laments, you know, of thousands of years of suffering and a sense of not just the material, but the pain and the emotion that that is part of the human experience.
We have a 1930 recording of Irving Berlin's Let Me Sing, and I'm Happy performed by Al Jolson. So let's take a listen.
What care I who makes the laws of a nation? Let those who will take care of its rights and wrongs. What care I who cares for the world's affairs? As long as I can sing its popular songs. Let me sing a funny song with crazy words that roll along. And if my song can start you laughing, I'm happy, happy. Let me sing a sad refrain of broken hearts who love in vain. And if my song can start you crying, I'm happy. Let me croon a low-down blues that lifts you out of your seat. If my blues can reach your shoes and start you tapping your feet, I'm happy. Let me sing of Dixie's charms, of cotton fields and Mammy's arms. And if my song can make you homesick, I'm happy. Let me sing a funny song with crazy words that roll along. And if my song can start you laughing, I'm happy, oh, happy. I want to sing a sad refrain of broken hearts who loved in vain. And if my song can start you crying, I'm happy, oh, oh, oh. Let me croon a low-down blues that lifts you out of your seat. If my blues can reach your shoes and start you tapping your feet, I'm happy. I want to sing of Dixie's charms, of cotton fields and a mammy's arms. And if my song can make you homesick, I'm happy.
All right, sister, what stands out to you about this song and the lyrics?
Many things. Let me situate for a second, first of all. By 1924, Irving Berlin was world famous. He was world famous as about 1911. And he had been married once. His first wife died a month after their honeymoon, sadly. He was a self-made man. He was famous. And he saw a world of possibilities in America. And he always was the rest of his life, of course, because you think of him writing things like God Bless America and as well as, you know, White Christmas and Easter Parade and things like that. But in 1924, a friend of his invited him to accompany him to the Democratic National Convention. And he went with him. And he was shocked because what happened at the convention was it became within a whisker of having a man elected for the Democratic nominee who had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And Berlin, remember, is this guy who had fled prejudice in Russia and saw America, of course, as a safe haven. And all of a sudden, here's this very clear threat. And I think he was terrified. And then actually he was right insofar as, and it's, you know, given the timeliness of what's going on in the world right now. But right after that election, when Coolidge was elected, one of the first things the Republican administration did was pass the laws of 1924, the immigration laws of 1924, which closed the gates. For the very first time, America was locked itself away from foreign immigrants. And Berlin retreated. He just really retreated. So I have actually two songs, and one is that one, Let Me Sing and I'm Happy. And what really strikes me about it is the melody is just wonderful. It's so cheerful. And you've got, you know, Al Jolson doing the definitive performance of that with all of his bravado and verve and, you know, energy. But the opening verse is, you know, what care I who makes the laws of a nation? Let those who will take care, those who will take care of its rights and wrongs. What care I who cares for the world's affairs, as long as I can sing its popular songs? In other words, he's retreating.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, you know, I just hope that they're doing it right. I'm just going to do what I can. You know, don't bother me. You know, let me be. Let me stay here. Let me be.
Yeah.
You know. And the songs, the verses are actually kind of interesting because they're of this weird flip because he says, let me sing a sad refrain of broken hearts who love in vain. And if my heart can start you crying, I'm happy. It's weird. It's like each one is sad. And he's like saying, you know what? Don't worry. I'll cheer you up.
Mm.
But from what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then another song, which I know you don't have a recording of, but I think is very pertinent as well in the same spirit, which he wrote in 1924. He actually wrote it for his friend Fanny Bryce of Funny Girl fame. And it was for a review. He had a review in New York at the Music Box Theater. And the song is called Don't Send Me Back to Petrograd. And again, remember, this is a kid who's, you know, am I safe in America? I thought I was. This is supposed to be the land of opportunities. This is the land of the Statue of Liberty, you know. So let me just read some of the lyrics to you if I can.
Sure.
Poor little immigrant feeling, oh so sad, I came from Petrograd with everything I had. And of course, Petrograd is in Russia. Now that I'm over here, they won't let me stay. That's why I'm so unhappy today. Please don't send me away. And by the way, there's a lightness to this. It's the words are, you know, the sentiments are very serious, but the melody is actually rather light. It was an entertainment for a review, you know. Anyway, here's the chorus. Don't send me back. I don't want to go back to Petrograd. Don't send me back. I don't want to go back to my hometown. The very best people that you know were once foreigners not so long ago. When they came over here, they were all immigrants. So were their cousins and their uncles and their aunts. Give me the chance. Thank you that you gave, sorry, give me a chance that you gave all my friends from Petrograd. I want to be in the land of the free and settle down. I'll promise to work the best I can. I'll even wash sheets for the Ku Klux Klan. Oh, don't send me back. It's terrible in my hometown. So, you know, he's a performer. He's an entertainer. He's a showman. He's a popular songwriter. But this stuff pops out.
Yeah. And, with,
and when demonstrates.
Yeah, I was going to put that with a lively little tune. You know, sometimes that message gets lost a little bit in
right.
the words, doesn't it? Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, the American musical was appealing to a wide array of audiences, and often these shows were taken to other cities. What's interesting, though, in reading in your book, they were primarily written for a New York audience. So why do you think this contributed so much to their mass appeal? And I guess they tweaked it a little bit as the show would go on the road.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, I mean, they were writing it for a New York audience. By the 1930s, the majority of the New York Broadway-going audience were Jews. I suppose part of that was because a generation before, they had all gone to the Yiddish theater. But now this is their children, and they're all college-educated, and they want to be more American. But there's still this element. And you wonder to what degree it's actually some kind of a, you know, not a secret code. I mean, that sounds way conspiratorial, which it wasn't. But there was, I think, a general understanding of, yes, this is it. And when you look at the shows over the course of time, you can see that these remain their concerns. They remain the concerns largely are, first of all, I suppose, safety and security. And secondly, assimilating like all immigrants did. And of course, we're a nation of immigrants. But assimilating like all immigrants do in order to gain acceptance and in order to enjoy the fruits of America and to achieve it's the American dream. So they shared all this stuff. But they're also, the dominant culture was basically Anglo-American, you know, what we sometimes call WASP culture, and which was, of course, very welcoming in so many ways. But there was still a sense of, but where are we, you know? So when you look at all these shows, it's fascinating to see. And I call it the double couple theory. It's my own little invention. But the point is that there are always two couples, and this goes back to, I think, Oscar Hammerstein, but there are always two couples, and the primary couple were largely white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you know, attractive people, and they were concerned about issues of love and marriage. But there was the secondary couple, and the secondary couple was almost always ethnic, and rather than being concerned with love and marriage, they were usually focused on sex. And rather than being serious, they were usually comedic. So you have a broad range of the audience, but also those aspirations built into each of these shows. No different than Shakespeare did. I mean, you've got Hamlet on one hand, and you've got the Gravedigger on the other. Hamlet's designed to appeal to the rulers, if you will, you know, the king, and in this case, Queen Elizabeth, and so forth. But the Gravedigger was there for the groundlings, for the everyday people, to give them a laugh. So there's a tradition. But what Hammerstein did was he ethnicized the second couple. And over time, you can see how the second couple becomes increasingly prominent, saying that ethnic peoples are part of the American experience. Diversity is part of democracy. This is part of the story of the American dream. And you see it in almost every major show, even to this day.
We're talking with Stuart Hecht. His new book is Transposing Broadway, Jews, Assimilation, and the American Musical. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Stuart Heck, an associate professor of theater at Boston College, longtime standing editor of the New England Theater Journal. His new book is Transposing Broadway, Jews, Assimilation, and the American Musical. You mentioned Oscar Hammerstein, but Rodgers and Hammerstein, the duo, well-known for contributions to the American musical. Tell us a little bit more about that partnership.
Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Yes.
Ah, goodness. Well, they're both from New York City, and they were both born within blocks of each other. Oscar Hammerstein's grandfather was a German Jew who actually founded an opera company that almost put the Met out of business. So he was born into that, you know, into that milieu. Richard Rodgers' father was a doctor, and they were rather affluent. In both cases, well, in the case of Hammerstein, the family sent him to Columbia University in New York, and he was supposed to become a lawyer, which I find a common story amongst many theater people. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, Columbia actually had a student-run original productions every year, student-written musicals. And he became involved in that, even though he was supposed to be studying for other stuff, you know. And Dick Rodgers, you know, he was, as a kid, his parents fought all the time, and yet they also went to see operettas in New York, and they'd come back with the sheet music. And apparently the only time they wouldn't fight with each other is when Dick would go to the piano as a little boy and start playing these songs, you know, so no wonder, you know, he had all these associations. But be that as it may, the point is that when Richard Rodgers was, I remember the age, I must say maybe 14, 15 years old, he first, he went to Columbia. And not because he was a student yet, but because they brought him in to work on these shows. He was a prodigy. And then he did work on the shows. So he knew Hammerstein from way back when. But he was younger, and someone said, well, you know, in those days, everybody had writing partners, and he wrote music. He needed a lyricist, and someone said, well, there's a guy who graduated a couple of years ago, and his name is Lorenzo Hart. He lives nearby. Let's go see him. So he wanders over to Hart's apartment, and Hart apparently appeared in his pajamas and sort of slovenly, and, you know, and they sort of said it was love at first sight, which I meant platonically.
Right.
But the point is that they just really complemented each other. And I think that's really important understanding their music. Hart was very cynical and very witty and very dark. And Rodgers' music is very upbeat and positive. I mean, the Rodgers waltzes are unbelievable, you know. And I think there's a tension between the lightness of the music and the seriousness of the lyric that made really defined a lot of urbanity in the New York musicals of the 1920s and 30s that they wrote together. Eventually, what happened, though, was that Hart was an alcoholic, and eventually he became less and less dependable, and Rodgers was more and more desperate. And he wanted to stop doing these urban, you know, shows like, oh, wonderful music, though. I mean, the great, great songbook, the Rodgers and Hart songs. But he wanted to do something in a different direction to stretch himself, I suppose, as an artist, and he found the script to Green Grow the Lilacs, which had been a semi-successful play, set in Oklahoma Territory. And so he wanted to do this, you know, set in, what do you mean you want to do something set in nature? You know, what do you mean you want to do something set in the countryside with all those hicks, you know, that kind of thing? And he wanted to work on this project. And Hart sort of said, you know, I'm not really up to it. It's not something I do. And you're close with Hammerstein, and maybe he could do something. And Hammerstein had a big career, but by this point had a series of about 10 years worth of flops. And so they teamed up. And again, I mean, they knew each other for, at that point, 30 years. It wasn't like a new thing. And that's where the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows came from.
Yeah. We have a recording of Getting to Know You from Rodgers and Hammerstein's The King and I. This is a teacher singing to her students, but you note there are much larger issues at work in the songs. Let's take a listen.
It's a very ancient saying, but a true and honest thought, that if you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. As a teacher I've been learning, you'll forgive me if I boast, and I've now become an expert on the subject I like most. Getting to know you. Getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me, getting to know you, putting it my way but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about you day by day. Getting to know you, getting to know all about you. Getting to like you, getting to hold you like me. Getting to know you, putting it my way but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about you day by day.
What else is going on in the song that might not be apparent at first?
Well, you know, everybody thinks of Rodgers and Hammerstein shows as being about Americana, and they certainly are. And they really are the foundation, I think, of American musical to this day. I mean, what year doesn't go by without a revival on Broadway of a Rodgers and Hammerstein show, you know? And they're not just New York shows by any means. I mean, they're accepted nationally and, of course, even internationally for that matter. But what's remarkable, I think, is that as much as we think of these as American shows, if you think about it, almost every show is about an outsider. And again, I think of that from the immigrant perspective. In the case of The King and I, which this is, it's really remarkable because on the surface, oh, here's this nice English lady and she's singing to these little children about how to welcome her and how she could welcome them and they should be comfortable with each other. But if you go just one step further, you say, wait a second, here's an outsider. This is Siam. This is 19th century Siam. And this is an English woman. And she's by herself. Mm. She's entirely isolated personally and socially and in terms of gender, in terms of nationality. And we could say, well, gee, is this about colonialism? She's going there to make Siam into a model of England. Well, to some degree, that's true. But it operates within the world of the Siamese and the king's wishes, and it's very much about that culture. So as much as she's singing, gee, you know, hey, kids, don't be scared of me, and we could be friends with each other, she's also saying, I am different than you. You are different than I. And yet we still can get along with each other.
Hmm. Stuart, you're right. Broadway musicals didn't themselves transform American beliefs, but they did encourage and support larger cultural issues to do so. So you write that what might seem like a risk really was a calculated risk.
Well, I think also an organic one. I mean, these are part of things that were happening anyway. I mean, the immigrants generation, and yes, I'm talking from Jews, I guess, but it's not just Jews. It was Italian and Irish and so forth, were becoming more and more part of the mainstream. I mean, you think by the 1950s and the late 1950s, the election of John F. Kennedy, I mean, you know, did signal, I mean, my God, he was Irish. Oh, my God, he was Catholic, you know. And then shortly thereafter with LBJ, the Civil Rights Acts, there was a sense at that time of immigrants becoming part of the mainstream and becoming part of the dominant culture, if you will. And I think that what happens by the time you get to, in terms of Jewish experience, from the 50s through the 50s, you get more and more of these ethnic characters not only being in the shows, but becoming prominent, even, dare I say, romantic leads, for goodness sake. And then when you get to something like Fiddler or Funny Girl, but Fiddler in particular, instead of it being in New York and, gee, there's these outsiders, suddenly you're in Russia. Mm-hmm. You're in that world entirely, and the outsiders are sort of just off stage. You never see them, and yet they're constant presence. So the transformation of the musical happens in ways that are not obvious per se, but the audience is willing to go with it. And it's not just because of Broadway. It's because these are trends that you see throughout the culture. I mean, you're having stars in the 50s like Paul Newman or, I don't know, you know, Tony Curtis, I mean, Kurt Douglas, all these who are all Jews, but also Irish, you know, and so forth. And I think that that marked a transformation in the culture. But the musical really cemented it. It presented it. It was a form that by that point was accepted and is a proclamation of American norms, a proclamation of American democracy and diversity in a positive, constructive way. And I think that's really its great gift. And I do think that the Jewish creators, because 95% of them were Jews, did that. Now, maybe they did it for themselves. Maybe, who knows? But regardless of what they did for themselves, everybody benefited and continues to benefit to this day.
Stuart Hecht is an associate professor of theater at Boston College and a longstanding editor of the New England Theater Journal. His book is Transposing Broadway, Jews' Assimilation and the American Musical. He'll be at the Jewish Congregation on April 2nd for a presentation titled Jews on Broadway, a Scholarly and Musical Exploration of Jewish Involvement in American Theater. We'll have more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Stuart Hecht, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mindy.
Also, thanks to Doug Shugarts and Tom Devlin for production assistance in Boston. Coming up after a break, Palm Sensation, a chorale performance featuring text from the Hebrew Bible.